Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Miles, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcon. You tell me.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in behavioral science. Welcome to yet another eye-opening show. Now, I went to brunch last Sunday with a few friends, and I had to run an errand on my way home, so I took side streets to get across Los Angeles since the traffic wasn't so bad on the weekend. And I started playing this game. Would I live on this street, in this house? Although the truth is, to afford a house in Los Angeles, I think you have to have a side business in human trafficking. But the one thing, as I was going along, I realized I get upset by, and yes, actually upset by, is seeing one of these sun-baked houses with no trees anywhere around it, or just one scrubby little tree withering somewhere in front. The streets I wanted to live on, and these were just in West LA, not uber-pricey Beverly Hills. The streets I wanted to live on were the ones with trees lining the streets, making a canopy over it on both sides. And the houses I picked, too, they had a lot of trees in front. They weren't the most glamorous houses. They were just the most tree-lined. Well, it seems my intuition isn't just intuition, but good sense. My guest tonight, psychologist and researcher Dr. Adam Alter, author of Drunk Tank Pink and Other Unexpected Forces That Shape How We Think, Feel, and Behave, notes that when there are trees outside your hospital window, it may very well mean the difference in whether you're healed enough from your gallbladder operation to go home Monday instead of Tuesday. On tonight's show, Adam will lay out this and other subtle influences that often have substantial effects on our thoughts, our beliefs, and our actions. Knowing these influences is the best way to avoid being swept away by them, so stick with us for a very interesting hour. Hello, Adam.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me on the show.
So glad you're here, plus a cute Australian accent. So let's start with the title of your book, which I love, Drunk Tank Pink. Tell us where that comes from.
It's a strange title. It's actually the name of a color. It's a very particular color, a shade of bubblegummy Pepto-Bismol-y pink. And it got its name from some research that was done in the 70s and 80s by some psychologists. And what they found was that if you took very aggressive prisoners and put them in a cell that had been painted with this very bright pink color, even the very most aggressive prisoners were much better behaved and they were much more calm and compliant just 15 minutes later. And basically, Drunk Tank Pink is an emblem for what I talk about in the rest of the book. It's just one example of the sorts of cues that influences how we think and feel and behave. And I chose it because it's such a vivid example. It's just so surprising to most people that just painting a room a particular color can make very aggressive people very docile.
There was other research on this that I was fascinated by Professor Alexander Schaus, where there were two large pieces of colored cardboard, and they showed these to men, and they actually had less strength if they looked at the pink one rather than the blue one, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty striking. They got 153 college-age students, all males, and they got them to stare at these two pieces of cardboard. And after they'd stared at the pink piece of cardboard rather than the blue one, when they were using a hand grip device, it's this device called a hand grip dynamometer. It basically measures how many pounds of force you can exert with your hands as a sort of basic measure of strength. And they found that when they'd stared at this pink cardboard, they were much weaker than they were when they stared at blue. And, you know, a lot of these effects are very subtle, but in that one study, 151 out of 153 men were weaker staring at pink than blue, which is a pretty staggering proportion.
Yeah, I think that's pretty amazing. And you look at this, you look at these effects like this throughout the book. I wanted to know what motivated you to write this book with all these sort of subtle effects that shape how we think, how we feel, and how we behave.
Yeah, it's a very broad book, and I think that's just because I just have a lot of interests, and I get pretty restless, and I end up jumping from topic to topic in my own research. It's basically a summary of what I've found most interesting in my life in the last, say, 10 or 15 years in the field as a psychologist who studies the effects of subtle cues in the environment on our behavior, on our thoughts, on our feelings. So what I ended up doing was when I started writing the book, I started writing down all of the effects that had stayed in my head that I'd learned about, thought were fascinating, were very surprising. And I noticed that they formed a set of 9 cues that I ended up focusing on in the book. And that's basically how the book began. And then I just followed my interests as I wrote the rest of it.
Now, are you better at some things in your life because you realize these influences?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a question a lot of people ask me after having written the book, am I better equipped to live my life? And I think I'm just as foolish and clumsy and bad at all sorts of things as everyone else. I think it's just totally exhausting and paralyzing to try and live your life too carefully. Now, some of the effects, I think, they apply to very basic, very large, very general decisions, decisions that are big and that have big implications for our lives. So, for example, in some of the research I talk about some factors that you might take into account when you're naming a child. Now, that's the sort of decision where understanding this information is very useful. Some of the other things I talk about are much more subtle. They're much more rapid. If you were paying attention to all of them, I think you'd be so exhausted that you wouldn't really have time to live your life.
Right, and I agree with you on that, and I also, but I feel that there are certain things that I learned going through your book that will help me. I can't focus on all of them, but the trees thing, for example, if I can ever afford to buy a house in Los Angeles as an engaged in child trafficking or something, or drug trafficking, then I would really look for something with trees, and I actually found it important. I thought, well, you know, I should actually spend more time around trees because I'm very urban. I don't like to be that far from cement at any moment, but maybe that's not so good for me. And so these are these influences, I think, where it's very helpful. You do help people realize these things, but you, like you said, cannot take everything and start living your life prescriptively from the book.
Yeah, that's right. I think the way I think about it is for any of the effects, I do a little cost-benefit analysis, and I try to work out how difficult it would be to enact whatever the suggestion is based on the research. So in the case of the trees, that's the cost side. Then, of course, the benefit side is how much do I get out of it. Now, for the tree example, the research that you mentioned there, it's very powerful research, and it shows that we function much better as healthier, happier human beings when we happen to be surrounded by nature, not just trees, but running water, a fountain, anything like that that reminds us of something that's not static, that's moving and that's natural. Now, the good news about that is if you don't want to buy an expensive property because you can't afford it or it's just not where you want to live, you can buy potted plants for the home. If you turn one of your windowsills, for example, into a little garden, that is enough. There's research showing even that subtle effect is enough to dramatically influence your well-being and to reduce the effects of negative stress. So, you know, it sounds new agey and it's difficult to believe the effects, but there's so much careful, systematic research on this that I totally believe it. And I think in that case, the cost of buying these potted plants for that one windowsill is so low compared to the benefits it seems to have.
And they look nice. Now, I have a question
on
this.
Too.
Well, can we fake it? I have kind of a black thumb, and somehow there's an orchid in my house that my boyfriend got me that has managed to live despite my intervention. it's like I'm poisoning it with lye instead of watering it with any plant. But my friend Nancy sent me these fake flowers in the mail that were on her desk, and I'm wondering, I have them in a thing on my desk, and they look real. So will those have the same effect, or does my body and mind, do my body and mind know that these are fake and they're Nancy's plastic flowers?
Yeah, the jury's out on that question because we are very sensitive. We're able to detect all sorts of fabrication and fakeness in that sort of area. Like, we can see the difference. Not always. Of course, you're always, you know, you see people who are fooled by fake plants and they think they're real, and that happens to all of us sometimes. But in general, once you know they're fake, or once you have a sense that they're fake, or even if you can see that they're fake just by looking, that can diminish the effect. What they say really captures us is it's often the movement of whatever the thing is. So if it moves in a natural way, say if you have some air that blows through it and the branches of the tree move, that really matters to people.
Okay, so I need to set up a fan behind my
fake
flowers. Okay,
exactly.
That really helps. And the water thing does work too. And actually, I knew that, and I set up a fountain, but I was afraid I would leave it running and then, you know, burn my house down. So like you said, the cost benefit, you have to consider that. And so that was my cost that seemed to be too great. So you just started a company. I wanted to ask you about that. You say that names are far more important than we might assume based only on intuition, and you write about something nominative determinism, which means just name-driven outcome. So tell us about this name-driven outcome.
Yeah, it's the idea that we are treading a path that has been paved by our names. So imagine a child, you give the child a name. There are certain features of that name that could end up shaping the way that child behaves, thinks, and feels. There are classic examples like the fastest man in the world over 100 meters or 200 meters at the moment is Usain Bolt. And Bolt obviously means fast. If he'd been, I sort of have this thought experiment in the book where I talk about what would have happened if he had been named Usain Plod or something ungainly. And it's a kind of a weird question, right? I mean, he would be the same physical specimen to some extent. He's got the same genes. But there's a lot of evidence that we are shaped to some extent by those names, quite surprisingly.
And people's expectations for us change. You wrote about a study I've talked about on my show before, the Blooming Study. I think it was in San Francisco, where teachers were led to believe that certain students would bloom academically, do very well, and they were just chosen at random. But that was predictive because of the teacher's beliefs.
Yeah, it's an absolutely classic study. At the beginning of the year, these students were assigned to different classrooms, and they were, as you said, randomly chosen. There was no difference between the children in one class and another class. But the one group had teachers who were told, the students in your class are bloomers. They're special students, and during the course of this next year, they're going to bloom. They're going to turn into academic stars. They may not be there yet, but we've done some testing, and we can tell that that's what's about to happen. And so over the course of that year, the students, although they began identical on all sorts of batteries of tests, there was a huge difference after a year. The teachers had taught them differently, had behaved towards them differently, had encouraged them more, and the bloomers scored about 10 to 15 points higher on various IQ tests than the students who were in classrooms where they weren't labeled bloomers.
Yeah, and the important thing was that these kids were chosen randomly, these kids who scored 10 to 15% higher, but somebody treating you like you were a star can make you live up to that.
Yeah, exactly. I think what's really remarkable about it is to try and get a sense of why, like what exactly happened. And you do get a sense when you think about how we respond to ambiguous information. You could imagine a child in either classroom who, you know, does some things well and some things not so well. If you're in the classroom where you think this kid is a bloomer, they do something well and you say, well, there's great evidence this person's about to achieve well, and then you feed into that. If you see that child doing something that's not so competent, they've made a couple of mistakes on, say, a math puzzle or whatever, you say, well, you know what, that's not a big deal. I know this kid's a bloomer. This was sort of a blip on the radar. And so you give them a little bit more leeway. And we do that all the time. You know, you have some big explanatory framework. You already know that this person has been labeled a particular way. You make all the stuff that you see afterwards you make that evidence fit whatever you already know. But if there's no evidence, you don't yet know that this kid is a bloomer, then you take the evidence at face value. And so when they struggle with that math puzzle, you say, well, maybe this kid's struggling and maybe I should treat them that way. And so it's pretty powerful, this label. Any labels we give anything that give it some like big structure, those labels have a big effect on everything that happens subsequently.
When we come back after our station ID, I want to talk to you about names and how they allow people to categorize us almost automatically. But this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is psychologist and researcher Dr. Adam Alter, and his book, out in very affordable paperback, just click on the link in the show description, is Drunk Tank Pink and Other Unexpected Forces That Shape How We Think, Feel, and Behave. And I have to say, his book is wonderfully written, and as someone who just completed a book that's a science-based manners book, it is so hard to write as clearly and excitingly as he does in science. So I'm sure that your head was probably bleeding for half a year afterward, but it's your book was a joy to read.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks, Amy.
So you say names allow people to categorize us almost automatically, and you talk about the Freakonomics authors. They describe the strong relationship between a mother's education and the name she chooses for her children, and you say, white boys, I'm quoting, white boys named Ricky and Bobby are less likely to have mothers who finish college than are white boys named Sander and Guillaume. And you also write that white girls named Alexandra and Rachel tend to be wealthier than white girls named Amber and Kayla.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's just simply a demographic fact. And we form associations in our mind effortlessly. We don't have to pay attention to them. But over time, if you meet enough people named Bobby or enough people named Sander or Guillaume or whatever the names happen to be, you will start to form an association in your mind. So, for example, again, there's another thought experiment in the book. If I say to you, someone has knocked on your door and that person's name is Dorothy, and you don't know anything about that person, you probably know enough just based on the name to hazard a guess about, say, Dorothy's age. You probably don't expect Dorothy to be 7 years old, for example. And you probably think that Dorothy's a white person because it's a name that a lot of white people have and few people who are not white have, and so on. And so these associations we form are quite important because later on when you meet the next Dorothy or the next Bobby or the next Guillaume, you have this baggage that you then, just as the Bloomer label had baggage that influenced how these kids were treated, you will treat Bobby and Sander and all these other people according to how you think people with that name tend to be.
And names being predictive, this can be a rough and sort of awful thing. You write that research was done that tacked on typically black or typically white names on an applicant's resume. So talk about how the applicants for jobs with the typically white names fared versus those with the typically black names. And I should say this is the same information that was sent out. It just had a black name versus a white name.
Yeah, that's right. Identical CV. There's no difference in the content of the CV. It's exactly the same background, same strengths, same weaknesses. Everything's the same. The only difference is this name at the top, which implies that the applicant is black or white. And if the application is weak, it doesn't really matter so much what the name is. The weak person will just be generally, they won't get many callbacks. A very strong application, in contrast, you will get many more callbacks, about 1.5 times as many if the name is white than if the name is black, which is a staggering effect and very unfortunate that that's the case.
It really is. Sorry about that little bark. There's a siren outside, and my tiny dog is defending
okay.
The universe. Now, you have such fascinating stuff in your book, Drunk Tank Tank, and one of the things that was so fascinating to me that I had not heard before was that people tend to like what belongs to them, down to the letters in their name. And you write that Belgian psychologist Joseph Nutten, great name,
yeah,
found that people prefer the letters that populated their names more than the letters absent from them, which is just fascinating. And you even said people donate more often and more generously to causes that share their initials. So K-name people, people whose names had a K in them or started with a K, were actually found to donate 150% more to Katrina charities than other disaster charities.
Yeah, that's right. And this is, as you said, this research is basically about the fact that we like ourselves. And so anything that reminds us of ourselves, we also pay more attention to and we like more than we like other things. So I've done this often when I give talks, and I'll present material from the book, and I will display on a screen behind me all the letters of the alphabet, and I'll ask people this pretty strange question. Just think for a minute about your 5 favorite letters of the alphabet. It's a totally random, weird thing to ask people to judge, you know, how much they like. But it's amazing afterwards if you say, how many of you picked the first letter of your first name or last name or both? And like almost every hand in the audience goes up and they all look around sheepishly and they all think it's really funny. But it shows you how powerful that effect is, and it's also surprising. It's not something we always think about. And so then when, as you said, hurricanes come through, you get Katrina coming through or Rita or Hurricane Sandy or whatever the storm may be, that same effect kicks in, that same attraction or greater attention paid to something that reminds us of ourselves. And so, as you said, Katrina comes through, people with K names will donate much more. Rita comes through, people with R names donate much more. I think the most interesting part of this piece of research is just when we talked earlier about this cost-benefit analysis thing, this approach. If you think about it, the way we currently name our hurricanes, we just go down an alphabetical list each year that's 21 letters long, and we just progress through that list from A down to whatever the last letter is in the list. I think they go down to U or V or W, and that doesn't make a lot of sense, because if we know that people give more to hurricanes that happen to share their initials, and we also know what names the American population holds, we can work out what names the wealthiest people in the population hold, the most generous people, or the greatest number of people, and then possibly attract those people more. And in some analyses we did, I basically found that you could increase aid over 12 years by about $100 million just by tweaking the names in the list, which is, you know, it's totally inexpensive as an intervention, and yet it could have huge benefits for hurricane aid relief.
Wow, this is so fascinating, and I want to call up the Hurricane Agency and suggest they actually start naming hurricanes more
just more specifically, like the Hurricane George Soros, Hurricane
right.
Donald Trump.
Exactly.
You know, just go right to the source. So now you and I share the initials AA in our first and last name. So tell us how that likely affected us in school and maybe beyond.
So one thing it did is, like when I got an email from you and I saw that your name was AA, you know, that sort of makes you pay more attention. It makes you but you were asking about school. You're not asking about just affiliation and how people respond to people with similar names.
No, well, both answer, because both were fascinating. You wrote about both. You know, that it is interesting, you know, what you're saying, we like the initials that are in our names. And so I also, you know, when I got your book and I saw Adam Alter on it, there was something, I didn't really realize this, but that appealed to me. And I thought it was just alliteration, but it was me-literation, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good term. I like it. We'll have to use that one.
Feel free. how does that affect us?
Well, with respect to school, I'm not really sure. You know, again, the jury's out. I think even that's probably a little bit generous to the research. There is some research that suggests that people with A names do slightly better at school than people with D names. And I feel sheepish saying that because you and I both have A names. But that's what the research, there's some research that showed just that. And the researchers basically argue that what's going on there is that because we're slightly attracted to our initials, you find that people with D initials are slightly more attracted to Ds and we are more attracted to A grades. And they have other results as well. They show, for example, that baseball players are more likely to get a strike, which is represented by the letter K, if they have K initials. And so they look at Major League Baseball stats from like 100 years, and they find that there's a slight rise in the number of strikes hit by K initial batters, which is also kind of fascinating.
So it is fascinating.
I spoke to some of the people who wrote that paper, and they aren't totally sure if they believe the effect, so I didn't end up mentioning it in the book. I had it in an early version of the book, but I didn't end up carrying it through and keeping it in the final copy. But I think it's a fascinating piece of research that deserves some more attention.
Yeah, that is very interesting, and I do like how you were. I perceive that you were careful about things. You would explain when stuff really wasn't that well supported. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is psychologist and researcher Dr. Adam Alter, and his book, and very affordable paperback, is Drunk Tank Pink and Other Unexpected Forces That Shape How We Think, Feel, and Behave. And so you talk about something else which is very interesting on names, that there's fluency and disfluency. Names that are easy to pronounce are fluent and difficult to pronounce are disfluent. And you give this great example. You talk about there is this race in 1986, the Illinois Democratic primary for lieutenant governor, and these two, George Sangmeister and Aurelia Puchinski, they were touted to win. But the people they were running against were Mark Fairchild and Janice Hart. And you say, when voters don't know a lot about their positions, they instead rely on cues, irrelevant cues, and you talk about heart and child in the names of the latter candidates. These are very appealing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, how do you run against someone whose surname is Hart and someone else whose name is Child, Fairchild or Child? It's just very, very difficult to try and frame that as a negative. And when your name is complicated or convoluted or hard to pronounce, people are less likely to repeat it. There's just this general effect in psychology that things that feel familiar or that are easier to pronounce or that we feel that we've heard before, we prefer. Because if you think about the course of time, you know, across an evolutionary scale, anything that's new or that's novel, we just always feel a little bit more reticent about, a little bit more careful about. But if something feels familiar, there's sort of the suggestion there that since we've seen it before, it hasn't hurt us yet, it's less likely to hurt us in the future. So we always reserve this little boost of positivity for things that feel either easy or familiar. And that's basically what fluency is all about, and it has some fascinating effects. I did some studies with some Australian researchers, and we looked at how quickly lawyers at American law firms rise up through the firm hierarchy to become partners. And basically what we found was that even if you remove all of the demographic baggage, you know, we were talking about Dorothy, that she's probably white and she's probably an older woman, even if you just focus on white American males, so you remove ethnicity and gender concerns, just looking at white American males, you see that in the middle parts of their careers, they're much more likely to be partners, about 10% more likely if they have simple, easy-to-pronounce names than if they have complex names. And that's just, it seems to be just a fluency premium that by having a simple name, they get a slight boost in the middle part of their careers, which is deeply unfair. But also, that's one of the examples where, you know, it's a big decision to name your child. You have the opportunity to shape certain outcomes for that child. Now, there may be other factors that you take into account, like cultural issues. You may want to use a name that's, you know, from a different language, and that's fine. But this is something worth keeping in mind, that all else being equal, it's great when you can choose a name that's easy to pronounce.
And actually, you point out, too, think about who your kid might want to be. You talk about this with company names. You say, you'd be happy to take a new drug manufactured by Zyntec and attend a party run by Balloomba, but Zyntec sounds like a hard-nosed party planner, and Balloomba seems too whimsical to engage in serious science.
Yeah, exactly. That's a separate thing, and that's exactly, I think, the idea that we have so many ideas about even the way sounds should be. That's the way something sounds tells us something about it. There's this classic experiment from the 1930s run by some German psychologists. And what they did was they gave people two shapes. The one shape was this sort of soft, curvy cloud, organic shape. And the other shape was a jagged sort of star that had a lot of very jaggedy sort of edges. And the researcher said to the people, one of these shapes is a Maluma, and one of these shapes is a Tachetti, and tell us which one is which. And that's a nonsensical question, right? I mean, these are made-up words, made-up shapes, and yet almost everyone, like 90-something percent, of, in the high 90s, about 98 or 99%, say that Maluma must be the soft, round shape, Tachetti must be this hard, jagged shape. And that has major effect. It changes how we name. We would choose a name more like Maluma for a girl than for a boy, and a name more like Tachetti for a boy. And then you see that people with these names, that also shapes their outcomes. There's an interesting study done in South Carolina looking at which women, which female lawyers were most likely to become judges, which is obviously the very pinnacle of the career, of that career path, of the legal career. And they found that women with names that were more masculine sounding were more likely to achieve that later on in their careers, which is, again, deeply unfair and quite a striking result.
Now, I always felt upset at being named Amy. It's one of those names, Amy, Stacy, Lori. It's kind of sort of, it's a name that it's great if you're six. And I always wanted to be named Alexandra, but I started writing, or just something of consequence. It sounded like someone's name who's powerful. And I always sort of thought that was a little dumb and ungrateful of me to my parents. But it seems that actually that might have been a good idea, that to change my name. And I wanted to ask you, for a parent naming a child, what advice would you give them?
Well, I guess it's a delicate subject, because a lot of parents will name their children after someone else, or there will be some sort of cultural element that they feel is very important to their identity. And so they'll, you know, if you move to a new country that speaks a different language, you may not want to pick a name that's fluent in that country, because you still have strong ties to your home country. And I think that's totally fine. What I would suggest is you can pick a name that's complex. You can pick a name that violates the rules of fluency and pick a disfluent name. But what you should do is arm your child, explain to your child when they're old enough that you're going to run up against this barrier, and what you're going to need to do is use your name more often. If it's extremely hard to pronounce, think about coming up with some sort of nickname or shortening. And if you don't want to do that, that's okay too, but give people a mnemonic or a rhyme or something that helps them to pronounce the name, so that they've at least got the tools that they need to make sense of your name, so they're not anxious about how to pronounce it. Because with a name like Amy or a name like Adam, we don't have too many people struggling to pronounce our names. But when that happens, there is great anxiety. I think it's very tough when you come up against a name you don't know how to pronounce. And the first time you speak the name, there's some awkwardness there. And that's the sort of awkwardness that in a very early initial interaction could be problematic, especially in a workplace setting.
That is great advice. And just to remind people, the disfluent names are the ones like Puchinski, and the fluent names are the easy to pronounce ones like Fairchild and Hart. That's fascinating advice, and
I can actually give listeners a very simple test. If you're trying to work out if a name is fluent or not, what you've got to do is, you can try this, and I've done this before, this is often how we determine in studies whether a name is fluent. You write the name down on a card, you turn it over, you give it to someone, and you say, imagine you're at the Oscars and you're about to announce this person as the winner. So you've just pulled that name out of an envelope. You get them to turn over, look at the name, and then tell you how anxious they feel about having to pronounce it, or how hard it'll be from like 1 to 10. And that's basically a measure of fluency. If it's easy, it's like a 1 on the scale like Amy would be, then that's very fluent. And if it's a name that they struggle with, there are like 2 ways that you could pronounce it, they're not totally sure, then it's going to fall at 5 or above on the scale. And that's a really easy fluency test, the sort of Oscar nomination test or the Oscar announcement test.
Wow, I like this test. Now, I want to move on to labels. You say that labels make a complex world simpler. They change how we see the world. And one fascinating thing you wrote about is that without labels, we are unable to categorize colors. And so in English, we use the word blue to describe both dark blue and light blue, but the Russians have a different word for each. And in research, how did this affect performance?
Yeah, it's interesting. If you ask people to distinguish between different colors that are very, very similar, so you have 2 shades of blue that are extremely similar, it's something that we as humans find difficult to do if they're similar enough. And what you find is that if the colors fall, so in Russian there's basically a different word for these different kinds of blue. So in English there's light blue and dark blue, but they're all just different versions of blue. In Russian there is a point where the color gets dark enough that it becomes named sini, S-I-N-I-Y is the English version of that. And when it becomes lighter it's called goluboy. And so you have completely different names. It's almost like the way we would distinguish blue from green, they have completely different labels in Russian for light blue and dark blue. So what that means is if we present a Russian-speaking person with the colors that fall just on the sini side and just on the goluboy side, they will distinguish those really quickly, much more quickly than English-speaking people will, because for us, our world is not shaped by 2 different labels for those. Our world is shaped by just 1. So basically, the idea behind the study is that the more names or words we have to describe the world around us, the more fine-grained our perception of the world is. So if you don't give people the language that they need to make sense of the world, it becomes, this is kind of controversial, but this research suggests that it becomes harder to see the world in all its shades and nuances.
I think that's fascinating. I can see how that's the case and how you would actually struggle cognitively if you have to describe something, as you described in the book with the people describing the light blue versus dark blue, when you have to say, well, it's very light, and instead of just having this word like whatever it was, Sine and Goluba, I forget. But those are so distinctive that it's a very quick thing. If you're Russian, you know that that's this word and that's that word, and you don't have to do a lot of explanation.
Exactly. It's just much simpler. It's just less mental work to try and see that the 2 things are different. And so these labels do play a really big role in categorizing the world for us and separating different things into different categories.
Now, there can be a problem with labeling. They can change outcomes, labels can. And you write that labels can cause us to see what isn't really there. And researcher Elizabeth Loftus, who does some amazing, and she's done some amazing work over the years on quote-unquote recovered memories, she did a fascinating study on how labels distort eyewitness memories by showing videos of car accidents. And so you don't have to remember this, do this from memory. She asked people to estimate how fast cars were going when they, quote-unquote, hit each other, and other subjects were asked to assess how fast the cars were going when they used these words, smashed, collided, bumped, or contacted each other. And what happened when she did this?
So they're all looking at exactly the same thing and trying to remember exactly the same footage, but they remember the cars going at different speeds depending on how the collision was described. When it's described as a smashing of the cars, they think the cars were going about 40 miles an hour. When they hear that the cars contacted one another, they think the cars were going 9 miles an hour slower, about 32 miles an hour, which is just striking. I mean, they're looking at exactly the same physical event, and yet they make sense of that information with completely different conclusions depending on what labels we used. Even more staggering for me, one of the questions they were asked afterwards was, did the one car's windshield break so that there was glass on the road? And if they were told that the car's smashed rather than, say, contacted, or I think it was smashed and I think it was contacted. I can't.
Smashed, but, collided, bumped, contacted were the others.
Yeah, in this other experiment, they were either told that the car smashed or that they, I think they collided. And when they heard that the car smashed, they were much more likely to misremember that there was glass spilled from the windscreen, which is also crazy because, you know, when you imagine in the real world you've seen an accident, you're called to be a witness in the crime, in the case, the lawyers have the power to shape your memory. Your memory is not solid enough that you will remember exactly what happened faithfully. Say, and this is only a few, you know, a few minutes after they've seen the video. Imagine if it's been a month or 6 months. You know, a lot of legal trials take forever to come to the courts. Imagine trying to remember something 6 months or a year later, and then these labels are just going to play a massive role in buffeting you from one conclusion to another.
It's so terrible. And Christopher Chabris, in his book on intuition, he talks about this, how damaging it is to have eyewitness testimony be so believed by us that nobody lays out the science here saying, look, here's how unreliable eyewitness testimony is, that here are the many ways that people can be swayed to think they saw something they didn't. And they're not being liars. It's just that they are, as you said, just the words used to describe the thing that they saw can lead them.
Yeah, and that's the foundation of the problem, that, you know, we have this sense that seeing is believing, that there's nothing more faithful than what I've actually seen with my own two eyes. And that's the root of the problem, because if we were more concerned about being accurate, if we thought there was a chance that we might not be accurate, that our view of the world was less faithful, then we'd be much more careful. The problem is this illusion that we have that we are so accurate and that what we've seen is totally 100% what was in out there in the world in reality. That sense of certainty is exactly the problem, because then we assume with great confidence that whatever we're saying is absolutely right. And so you never get any feedback on events like this. Like, you could go through that trial, someone says smashed, you're totally certain that there was glass on the road, but you're wrong. And very rarely are you corrected where you actually see the evidence that you were 100% mistaken. And so we go on making these errors time and time and time again because we just never get the kind of feedback that you would need to try to change or improve the way you're making these judgments.
Now, another thing that really influences us is the presence of other people and the characteristics of other people. And there's a fascinating example where you say the physical presence of a competitor shouldn't matter much in the cerebral game of chess, but actually it has an enormous impact on performance. So talk about what happened when male chess masters played against some hot female chess experts.
Yeah, so this is it's a great study. It was run by some economists in Sweden. And what they wanted to do is to look at whether, you know, the most rational people, the people we think of as being arch-rationalists, are chess players who are basically looking moves ahead at all times. You know, the difference between a good chess player and a great one is how many moves ahead you can see, how many different permutations you can play through in your head. So these people are serious thinkers, and what they're doing, they're very serious about. So you would think that maybe things that sway novice chess players wouldn't have much of an effect on these players. But what they did was they looked at what happens when these players come up against attractive female opponents. And the results were kind of staggering. They make many more risky moves. It's almost like there's this throwback to their evolutionary past when, you know, men had to impress other women, impress women by showing them how risk-seeking they could be, that they had enough resources to still be able to take risks and come through that unscathed. And so these men there, who we normally think of as being so careful, are making these crazy opening moves, moves that they would never normally make. And then they go on to lose many more matches because the moves they make throughout the course of the game, when an expert looks at them, they can see that this person who's characteristically very conservative and careful, faced with this attractive female competitor, ends up making all these moves that are kind of crazy, a little bit outlandish, a little bit risky. So sometimes they win spectacularly, and that's great. And more often, they lose because they're doing something that they wouldn't normally do, and it's a bad idea.
And this happens also in another unconscious way, which is so amazing. You write about Jeff Miller and Josh Tiber's study on how men unconsciously
sorry, men unconsciously tip better to strippers who are ovulating. I can't get that sentence out. They don't do this. They don't tip better because the strippers are wearing a sign saying so, of course. And not that these men would even care, but they do. So this is one of these subtle signs we don't even know.
Yeah, I don't think we're really sure. If you ask the researchers, I don't even know that they're really sure exactly what's going on. It's possible that the women are behaving a bit differently. I think that's a big part of it. But there are also questions about what the men can detect subconsciously. They don't even know what they're detecting. But perhaps they can tell something that this woman, when she's ovulating, you know, she's fertile. And so it makes more sense if we're just generally, as a gender, trying to appeal to women. If heterosexual men are just generally trying to do that, it makes more sense to do that, and there's a better outcome there available if they are ovulating. So it's possible that they're just picking up on these very subtle cues, and that automatically makes them more expansive, more willing to spend. So it's a very interesting effect. I found it fascinating when I read about the research.
Well, I will add to that, Marty Hazelton at UCLA has done work on ovulation, and they found in their studies that women dress more sexy. They wear more lower cut clothes. I think they might wear more red. I can't remember if that's just my mind or if that was what the studies said. But that they, when they are ovulating, they do wear tighter, more body-fitting things. And so it seems probably, I would guess, I can't remember Jeff and Josh's study, but what it specifically said, but I would suspect that maybe the effects are on both sides, and men pick up on this somehow, but that the women are also signaling this unconsciously.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I do think it's from both sides. I'd forgotten about that research by Marty Hazelton, but it's a fantastic complement to the research on the tipping, because I think it shows so nicely. You know, this is the best kind of research where it's programmatic and you can put these studies together and it really illuminates and paints a really nice picture. Here you can see the behavior. You can see people tipping more, and then Marty Hazelton's research shows you why that is. And so I agree. It's probably more about the way the women are behaving. I can imagine them behaving a bit differently. It may not be something as overt as wearing different clothes or dressing differently, but it could just be in the sort of subtle non-verbal behavior differences.
Yes. Now, when we come back, I want to talk about this fascinating chapter on cultural differences. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is psychologist and researcher Dr. Adam Alter, and his book is Drunk Tank Pink and Other Unexpected Forces That Shape How We Think, Feel, and Behave. So you write that we in America have this individualist focus, whereas those from East Asia, which is Japan, China, Korea, for example, are collectivist cultures. So explain what this means, and then how this plays out in our thinking.
In the broadest terms, it describes the way we think of other people and our interactions and relationships to them. And the idea behind individualism, which is what we tend to lean towards in the US and in Western Europe, in England, in South Africa, in Australia, in those countries what we tend to do is we tend to see ourselves as isolated individuals. That we don't really think our outcomes affect other people very much. We think that our own personal gain is paramount. It's a little bit more important than the gain of other people, particularly strangers. We see ourselves as very separate from them. Obviously, we have close others like spouses and, you know, family members, and that's different. But in the world at large, we see everyone as separate. Collectivism, which, as you mentioned, is more common in other parts of the world, like East Asia, is sort of the opposite view. It's the view that we're all interlinked, that our outcomes are dependent on one another's outcomes, that whatever I do should be for the benefit of everyone else, that it's not so much that my benefits and my well-being is paramount, but that the well-being of the whole, of the group, is paramount. And that can have some very interesting different sort of divergent outcomes depending on whether you're in an individualist culture or a collectivist culture. And it's some of the most classic research in psychology, I think.
One you write about that I found fascinating is that it affects how we see pictures of an object on a background, how much prominence we give the background, and that the people from East Asia had a different view than the people from our individualist culture.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, there are a few different studies. In the one study, what you see is five cartoon figures, and so there is one person who's out in the front, and then there are four people in the background. And the person in the front has a different facial expression from the people at the back. So imagine you can see this big smiling face, but then there are four people in the background who look really sad. And if you ask a person in an individualistic culture what the person in the front is feeling, they will say, oh, this person's smiling, doesn't matter what the other people are doing, it's pretty clear that this person's happy. If you ask someone from a collectivist culture what the person's feeling, they'll say, oh, I don't really know. There are these other people in the background who are frowning or they're sad. Maybe this person's faking it. I mean, they can't really be happy with all these sad people around. And so they make completely different assessments of the same stimulus just based on how much they think that one person is being influenced or is influencing the other people.
I find this so fascinating. And also the speculation, and you're very good on science in your book. You're very rigorous. You say when it's speculative. And there is this theory that individualism came to the fore in ancient Greece while Confucians pursued collectivist philosophies due to the concentration of disease-causing microbes. And there's a lot of research on this. I've read some of it about how it affects things way beyond whether or not you're going to step in dog poo.
Yeah, it's pretty striking, right? I mean, that just that people having grown up in an area like over thousands and thousands and thousands of years, some areas of the globe tend to be often warmer, areas tend to have more microbes and germs. And the suggestion based on this research, which is, I found it pretty convincing, but some people aren't so sure about it, is that collectivistic cultures came out of these areas where there were strong microbe populations and that there was more disease because in those places people banded together more and they were more concerned about outsiders and they kept outsiders at bay. And so they became much more focused on this in-group idea that it's important to have this strong cohesive in-group. Whereas in other areas of the world where there weren't so many germs, we turned out more to be individualistic and to be more about the individual, less concerned with this collective unit as a whole.
And now, what I found fascinating in your book, one of the many things, was how symbols from other cultures affect us, causing us to think in a different way than we probably normally would. And you did some pretty fascinating research on this using the yin-yang symbol.
Yeah, that's right. We did some research in New York City, and we did a number of different studies. In the one study, we had a research assistant who was wearing a shirt. We had these shirts made. One shirt was just a plain white shirt, and another shirt was the same shirt, but it just had a small yin-yang symbol on the pocket. So it was basically just as you met this person, that was the first thing you saw was this yin-yang symbol. And a lot of Americans know a little bit about the yin-yang. Some know more about it than other people. It's an ancient Chinese Taoist symbol. It's basically suggestive of the extremes and the movement between extremes like night and day, summer and winter, and how the world just kind of ebbs and flows between these different endpoints. And so if you're thinking about things like the weather or the stock market, thinking about the yin-yang in that context suggests that things will change, that change is imminent. If the stock is doing well, it's going to do badly. If the weather's been sunny, it's going to be rainy. If it's been rainy, it's going to be sunny. So what we find is when this research assistant approaches people who know what the symbol means, they tend to think there will be more change in the world at large than if the research assistant is wearing the plain T-shirt without the symbol. So you can really change the way people are thinking with these cultural symbols if they know what they mean and you basically put them in the field of view.
Yeah, it's so interesting to know these because you can see, I see throughout your book how influenced we are, and we just don't even realize it, by things like the weather, light. Another thing you bring up is how we are this social species. And I think that this is something people do not realize, how damaging social isolation is to us. And you write about how this can rather rapidly lead to madness and depression.
Yeah, this is just a staggering anecdote. In the 1950s and 60s, a lot of people were very interested in the space race. And, you know, it was very hard for most lay people to contribute to the whole cause because the whole thing was so specialized and rarefied, but a lot of people wanted to be involved. So this French, I guess he was an adventurer, decided that he wanted to contribute to the cause. And so he said, well, one of the things that we obviously need to think about is that astronauts who go out to space, as we get more sophisticated with our technology, will spend longer and longer periods of time away from human contact. And so he wanted to explore what would the consequence of this be. And so he thought about what the best analog would be on Earth for the sort of isolation you'd experience in space. And since space is dark and there's not much going on in there, up there, he basically said, I'm going to go down in deep, very deep into a cave and just live there. I'll make sure that I have all the things that an astronaut would have, like food and maybe some magazines and, you know, some stuff that would keep him a little bit occupied. But he wanted to see if he could stand being away from other people and how long he could do that for. And now, he was totally into this. He was really excited about it. He went down there out of choice. It's not like he was a prisoner who'd been, you know, told that he had to be in isolation. But pretty quickly, he kind of descended into madness. He started to hallucinate. He wasn't sure what was real. He lost a sense of time passing. One of the sad things he says is that he made friends with a little mouse and then accidentally killed the mouse, which is just like so devastatingly sad. And, you know, he said he writes about it in his diary that he descended into the pits of depression. And, you know, it's very sad when you kill a pet mouse, obviously. But the degree to which he was trying to extract that just, you know, drop of contact that he couldn't get from anywhere else from the mouse, that social contact, is just a really good illustration of how much we're seeking that in the world around us. When you don't have it, all you have is this little mouse. You're going to get all of it from there. And it showed just how powerfully we're affected by this isolation that he experienced.
And it's so incredible that we put these people in solitary confinement. We're not supposed to have cruel and unusual punishment. I forget how it's said in the Constitution, but that we do this to people, and it is really a terrible thing, and does not help people become reformed citizens.
Yeah, it's terrible. I think it's a little bit like the question of eyewitness testimony. Like we think that what we see is faithful and true, and we basically feel something similar about torture where there's no physical mark. Like we convince ourselves that putting someone in isolation is way less bad than beating them or punching them or injuring them physically. But it turns out, like, if you break someone's bone and that bone heals, that is probably far less damaging in the long run, even though in the beginning it looks terrible and it's probably extremely acutely painful. It's way less damaging in the long run than putting someone in solitary confinement for even a brief period of time. If you interview prisoners who have been put in solitary where they don't have any contact from anyone else for even sort of a moderately long period of time, a few days, they report that they just have these experiences psychologically that are so devastating and so powerful that they struggle to ever overcome them. It's just such an acute form of deprivation that they never really come back from it.
It is so horrible. I was really struck by the story of the mouse and this quote from your book about his name was Sif. He pondered suicide only to befriend a mouse that renewed his will to live. You know, you see how far down someone thinks that the mouse that they encounter in a cave is their reason to go on.
Yeah, it's really tragic. When I read that, I just thought it stimulates such pathos. It's just so sad to imagine this guy in the darkness of a cave. He has only one thing to live for because he's struggling, and it's this little mouse, and then he accidentally kills the mouse. I mean, it's the perfect sad story. It really is pretty heart-wrenching.
Now, another way we're affected socially is that there's research on comparison to other people. And you talk about this research starting in 1890 that first suggested that humans are often faster and stronger when they test their speed and strength in the company of others, but there were inconsistencies in later research. So lay out the findings for us.
Yeah, this is a really big puzzle for many years in social psychology. So one of the very first social psychology experiments was this experiment looking at what happens when people who are cyclists at a university, like college cyclists, are on stationary bikes alone in a room versus in a room with other people on bikes next to them. And the researchers basically reported in that study and a number of others that having someone else around was a really good thing, that these people do much better when there is the presence of an audience, of some other person in the room. But then there were findings later on that contradicted that. They basically found that depending on the context, sometimes having people in the room is a bad thing. It doesn't help you, it hurts you. So, I mean, you know, every school kid knows this, that when the teacher's looking over your shoulder and you're trying to complete math puzzles, there's nothing worse. It's impossible to think. You get anxious and it undermines your ability to do what you're supposed to be doing. So in the 60s, psychologist Bob Zients, who's responsible for some of the best studies in the history of the field, I think, basically worked out what was going on, and he suggested with a number of very clever studies, actually using cockroaches, that, I know, it's amazing that he managed to do this with cockroaches, but he showed that when the little cockroaches were in an easy maze, when they just had to run along a platform to get food, if you put up this little like stand, like a stadium, and had other cockroaches watching the one, you know, star Usain Bolt cockroach, that cockroach ran extremely fast and was much quicker to get to the food when there was an audience. But if you made the maze difficult and you made it really hard to get to the food and they had to like navigate and use all their resources to try their best to work out what was going on with the maze, an audience was a bad thing. So the puzzle was solved, because basically what happens when you have an audience is whatever's the dominant behavior, the thing that you would do like easily, like running or cycling, you will do much more of that more easily. But if it's complicated and you need your mental resources to basically work out through the complication, then the worst thing you can do is have an audience.
And I liked how you broke this down. You used the word instinctive. You said, you know, the instinctive things are, you know, that those go well for us with an audience, and that the difficult concentration-requiring things are the hard ones.
Yeah, exactly. It's whatever is instinctive, what's dominant, whatever would happen naturally, you will do more of that thing. It'll come out in sort of an exaggerated form when you're being watched by other people. If it's a thing that's hard and you need concentration, you get the very opposite. You get more of bad stuff creeping in because you don't have the resources you need. You're overloaded by being watched, and the outcome is negative.
And I think this is something very important to know, the bystander effect, how having too many witnesses to something bad happening to a person can cause all of them to stand down instead of doing something.
Yeah, this is classic research. It was done by actually my graduate advisor at Princeton, John Daly, and Bib Latané, two great social psychologists. In the late 60s, they'd heard about this case in New York that was very tragic. There have been a few books written about it recently because I believe it's an anniversary. I think it might be 50 years since then. This woman was killed in plain view of a whole lot of people. This was the argument. And some New York Times reporters wanted to know what was wrong with these New Yorkers who had been witnesses to a murder and had done nothing about it. They hadn't called the police. They hadn't intervened. And so the New York Times writers and various other writers were saying, well, there's something corrupt about New York City. It's turning these people into bad people. And Daly and Latané said that's probably not true, because as we know as social psychologists, so much of what's going on in our lives is determined by situation. It's not that these people are corrupt, it's that there's something about the situation. And they made this really smart counterintuitive claim that there are more people watching a crime, but the more people that watch, the less likely any one individual is to act. And they constructed a whole lot of very clever experiments showing that if you happen to come upon an emergency, having other people there for various reasons makes it less likely that you'll do something, because they can take the brunt of the responsibility. It lessens how much of the burden is on you. And also, we're also kind of worried that maybe we're misinterpreting. If there's someone else there, I don't want to look like the idiot who kind of freaks out and thinks it's a problem when everyone else is totally calm. And so in the end, no one does anything. It's this weird, really weird social dynamic.
I wanted to say this is a Kitty Genovese case, but I read about this, I wrote about this in I See Rude People, and it turned out much of the New York Times reporting was wrong on this. Someone did call the police, and she wasn't out in plain view. But I think it's really important to realize this bystander effect. And Richard Wiseman, who I had on my show, the British psychologist, he had this great idea, which is that if something's going on, that you call out to somebody in the crowd, hey, you, guy in the blue, call 911, because otherwise everyone will stand there with their finger up their nose thinking,
right,
well, if someone should call, they would have called, so I must not be, it must be wrong for me to call. It would be stupid.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, John has mentioned the same sort of intervention. The basic idea is that you want to burst this bubble of lack of responsibility, this diluted responsibility. And so you have to make sure that someone in the audience who's watching this emergency feels the responsibility. And the best way to do that, as Richard Wiseman suggests, is to say, you do this, you do that. And, you know, it's even true in emailing. Like if you send an email out and it's clear to the people who are receiving the email that they're on a list and you're asking, say, for help with a favor, so you want people to attend something or to read something, always better to send an individualized email to each person, because then the responsibility is 100% on them. No one else can step in to take over and do the job on their behalf.
So we are almost out of time. It has been such a fascinating hour. I have been talking with Dr. Adam Alter. His book, out in paperback, is Drunk Tank Pink and Other Unexpected Forces That Shape How We Think, Feel, and Behave. So just leave us with some final words of advice.
Well, I think the basic idea in this book is that there are all these things that shape us in ways we might not expect, and we've touched on a lot of them in this hour. There are two things you can do here, and this is sort of the reason why I wrote the book. If you know that they exist, if you know that using a particular way to name will lead to good outcomes, you can harness these really beneficial effects that most of us allow to slip by unnoticed to improve your life in all sorts of different areas, at work, at school, in your relationships, in all sorts of different contexts, in health. And that's the one thing you can do. The other thing you can do with this knowledge is some of these effects are really insidious and they lead to bad outcomes in our lives. We talked about the eyewitness the eyewitness memory example. Sometimes we are swayed by these cues in ways that are really unhelpful, but it's by knowing that they exist, that they're there, and being educated about them that we can do something about them to stave them off. So I think it's the main thing is just to try, if you know that these things exist, you can harness some of them for the good, and the others you can stave off to reduce the bad.
Adam, thank you so much. I've been talking with Adam Alter, author of Drunk Tank Pink and Other Unexpected Forces That Shape How We Feel, Think, Feel, and Behave.